Hi, everyone. I hope you're doing well. Welcome back to Better Than Bad. I'm your host, Jess. First of all, I just want to apologise if you can hear my fan blaring in the background. It's because we currently have like a big heat wave in the UK and I just refuse to switch it off. I don't want to melt. I love this podcast, but I'm not that dedicated. I'm sorry. So if you can hear it in the background, I'm so sorry. Please forgive me. I hope everyone is having a lovely day wherever you are. If you're in the UK, I hope you've survived this heat wave. If you're outside of the UK, I hope you're enjoying laughing at us trying to survive this heat wave. And I really hope that you enjoyed the last episode of the podcast. If you didn't get a chance to listen to it, you would have missed out on the fact that I was joined by Billy. We discussed Adam Driver's highest and lowest rated films. So if you do want to listen, head on back and listen to that now. You'll hear us ramble on for over an hour about Marriage Story and then talk about The Dead Don't Die for about 30 seconds. but today I am back, and I am back with another guest, because today I'm joined by the fabulous Zoe Wells. Hi, Zoe.
Oh, hi, Jess.
How are you? Are you cool? Are you calm?
I'm cool. I'm calm. It's maybe not calm, maybe just like enforced relaxation because of the heat.
Yeah. I've just decided not to do anything in these, like this heat wave. I've just been lying down.
Yeah. And just I take meetings. That's it. Yeah.
I will only take meetings today.
Yeah, that's me.
So me and Zoe, we go way back. We are school friends.
Long time. Really
we
long time.
We went to school together.
Yeah. How long do you reckon it is? Like in real time, what were we saying? 12 years? Longer, surely.
Longer, surely. Because when did we start school? Actually, I don't know whether I want to think about this because it's just going to make me really
Also not disclose it.
Yeah, no one needs to know. Yeah, me and Zoe, we used to do loads of like drama together at school, and she's an actor, writer, director. You've done it all. You've literally done it all.
Yeah. I'm trying to focus a little bit more.
But do you want to tell the people who we're going to be discussing today?
Yeah, so today we are going to be discussing one of my did you know that this is one of my favorite actors?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, he's genuinely, I have a huge crush all round on him, Dev Patel. A professional crush, a personal crush, you know, that kind of thing.
The whole thing.
The whole thing. But yeah, you've got some facts on Dev, haven't you?
Yes. So the reason we're discussing Dev, well, actually, hilariously, is that he's one of your favourite actors. Our other school friend, Hayley, was the person who recommended that we discuss him today. Because he is also one of her favourite actors. So all the school friends are coming in strong.
Same minds,
Dev Patel. So for those who don't know, Dev Patel is an English actor who made a name for himself initially when he starred in the first two seasons of Skins. He then went on to star in films such as Slumdog Millionaire, which sort of got his name out there internationally. And he was nominated for an Oscar in 2017 for his role in Lion. So obviously, I guess the reason you wanted to discuss him was primarily because he's one of your favourites.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, and I will say this before we get started, and I will keep returning back to it in terms of these films that we're discussing. I think one of the reasons he's one of my favourite actors is because on screen, he manages to do something really difficult, which is be completely fizzing with energy, but it all feel totally sincere. You know, sometimes you see somebody with charisma on screen and you're like, is that just a secondary role that you're also painting for yourself? Like, have you created this idea of an actor that does this kind of thing and now you get all of those parts and you do that kind of stuff? But I just feel with Dev, like, every single thing he does has that layer of sincerity with it without being cringe. And that's really difficult. That is so difficult.
He's just great.
He's so great.
Just a 10 out of 10. Great. So the films that we're going to be discussing today, on IMDb, his highest rated film is, well, it's a tie between Lion and Slumdog Millionaire, both of which have 8 stars. Now, I kind of took the selfish route, and because I'd never seen Lion before, I decided that we would discuss Lion rather than Slumdog Millionaire, because I've seen Slumdog Millionaire before. So yeah, today we're going to be discussing Lion, and his lowest rated film with 4 stars is The Last Airbender, which I had also never seen before. Had you seen either of these films before?
So, no. Lion's been on my list for a very, very long time. Since it was nominated, I think. I do try and work my way around the Oscar noms. So I know that if I've got an opinion on it, it's not founded in hearsay. But I hadn't seen it. But I was going to ask you, I was like, it's interesting to me that Slumdog isn't the highest rated, but they are... They are kind of the same. They're a tie. Ah, that's really interesting. But yeah, I'd never seen either of them before. And I'd never even considered watching The Last End of it. I'm not going to lie to you.
Yeah. Well, we're going to actually start off by talking about The Last Airbender because it came out first. So some facts for the listeners. So on IMDb, yes, it has 4 stars. It was released in 2010. It was directed by M. Night Shyamalan, who also wrote the screenplay. It stars Noah Ringer, Nicola Peltz, Dev Patel, obviously, and Jackson Rathbone, who most of you will probably know as Jasper from Twilight.
Sensational.
It is a live-action remake of Avatar The Last Airbender, which was a Nickelodeon animated series that ran from 2005 to 2008, and is very highly regarded as an animated series. I don't know about how knowledgeable you are on animated series, Zoe. But,
no, I'd say so, yeah. When I say The Last Airbender, I wouldn't watch it. I mean the film, but as a child, you know, that was knocking about. That was serious stuff.
Yeah. It's considered by some to be one of the best animated series ever made, and IGN actually listed it at number 35 in their top 100 animated series lists.
Wow, that's high.
And yeah, and for reference, obviously the film has 4 stars on IMDb. The TV series, the animated series, has 9.3.
Oh, God.
The difference, my guys. The difference.
Gosh.
And I guess that's kind of where the lack of success with this film kind of begins, because the source material is so loved, so revered, that when it came to doing the live action, the standard was so high that I feel like it probably just didn't meet that standard.
Yeah, I wonder if it was a case of, as well, to me it felt like when I was watching the film, what they were doing is they were literally making a live action version of something that was animated. And, you know, some of those things that work or are kind of like an element of the genre in terms of animation, translating those into live action, you kind of do have to drop them out a little bit. And I would say maybe Mulan is a really good, a really good indicator of how you have to drop things out and do things differently when it comes to live action. And it just felt like, to me, it felt like actually M. Night was probably a huge, huge fan of the series, and so wanted to replicate it. But in that replication, it just kind of, I mean, just wow. Am I right?
Yeah. I did a bit of maths, which is very, it's very rare for Jess. She hates maths. I don't like maths, but I did work out that, so the original animated series, it had 3 seasons, and it had 61 episodes overall, and each of those episodes was about 23 minutes long. So that's roughly just under 24 hours worth of material. Yeah, the first season, which is what the film is based on, was 20 episodes long. So that's about 7.5-8 hours worth of material that they crammed into a film with a runtime of 1 hour and 43 minutes.
I mean, it's a swift film, isn't it? It chunters by.
It's a really short film. And I read somewhere this morning when I was doing some research about it that M. Night had said that most of his films are around the 90-minute mark. So he just naturally fell into cutting it down to being that short. But this film, in terms of the rest of his work, is very different from the rest of his work. A lot of his other work is sort of a horror, thriller kind of vibes. So and that kind of fits really well into that 90 minutes. But there's a lot more to it. So for me, I don't know about you, but it just felt really rushed.
It did feel really rushed. And actually, the really interesting thing is to watch it alongside Lion, which obviously is the polar opposite, right? Mm-hmm. I did feel it was really rushed, but I did feel like, that's the one thing I would say about this film. I did feel the edit was quite, for the audience that it was going to, and it wasn't a pan in terms of the money it made, because it made all of its money back and more, you know, it turned a pretty healthy profit, I think. And I think that's because they knew that their audience was going because they loved the TV show. Mm-hmm. And so it did feel like it kept my attention. It did keep my attention. I didn't feel like I was, you know, dragging my heels at any point.
I haven't seen the animated series in its entirety, but I've seen like the first part of it. Mm. And it was really funny watching the first part of the film and then comparing it in my head to the first part of the animated series.
Yeah.
Because the what takes like four episodes took like, they gave like 10 minutes to it in the film. Yeah. And I was just, and I know that obviously when you're adapting something from a TV series that has a lot of time to kind of flesh out these characters and you put it into a film, they're going to have to cut things out.
Yeah.
But it felt like rather than cutting things out, it was like they rushed through a lot of it.
They zoomed through.
Or if they couldn't put a scene in, they just had the girl doing a voiceover explaining what happened in between.
I will say, I don't think it's the worst film I've ever seen. I would just like to like hands up say that. But the dialogue was so, so kind of completely honest at all points, and I was like, guys, leave some mystery please.
Well, yeah, I don't know about you, but that made the dialogue feel a bit clunky at points. Oh, because
a bit
I'm trying to be nice. It was just like, it felt like they would just, it's over explanation. I think sometimes it's like they were treating the audience like they're a bit stupid. And it's like, we can figure some of this out on our own. We don't need to be explained absolutely everything. But at the same time, you need to also be showing us what it is that we're supposed to be understanding. And there was no time either to just get to know these characters. It was like, you're introduced to them and then you're straight onto the action. And obviously in a sort of action film, you don't want to spend too much time just on the characters, because the big point of people going to see these films is for the big action sequences and whatnot. But a part of the, you know, The Last Airbender, or at least the animated series, is that there is so much story within this series. And it felt like that was almost sidelined for these very big action sequences and things like that. Like, the story was kind of rushed through so that they could show off the cool VFX that they had going on. Which I will admit, to be honest, I don't know about you, but I did think the VFX was actually pretty good in this.
Yeah, I, like, no complaint. Like, you know, it felt like everybody was doing their jobs, but they were doing them very singularly. So kind of as a whole, it was, you know, pockets of it were like, oh, okay, fair enough. And then you're also like, that didn't quite match up, did it? I think it's really interesting what you say about the characters in terms of like any kind of development. In terms of like aiming at a certain like group of people, obviously I think this is aimed at a generation of children, or a new generation of children, like bringing The Last Airbender to them. And in opposition to like what I would say is maybe one of the most successful children's films of recent times and critically acclaimed, Paddington, there is so much character development. That is only character development, right? And it is only facial expression, and it is only like, you know, nothing is told, like everything is shown. And I really expected Dev's character in particular to become a very Kylo Ren situation. And it felt like, okay, we're gonna go there, let's go there, let's see him, you know, smash up a console with a lightsaber. No, but we didn't get there with Dev. And it felt like he had the potential to be doing that, but owing to the, as you say, absolute paciness of it, we never could see that.
Yeah, and I think because this was originally, they originally planned for this to be a trilogy of films, because the there's three seasons of the show. Each of them is like book one's water, book two's earth, and I think the last one's fire. I think so, and this was book one, water. So I think that the plan was for it to have each film be the corresponding season. And I'm pretty sure from my knowledge of the TV show that Dev's character, Zuko, becomes, he's sort of like the anti-hero of the of the piece, very, you know, like you said, very Kylo Ren. So that was probably where that would have headed had they continued with the series. But obviously after the sort of critical and public backlash of the heat film, for they just decided to you know, shelve them, shelve the rest, even though, as you said, it didn't do bad money wise. I saw that it was, I think it's something like, it was the fourth highest grossing film that Nickelodeon's ever made.
Yeah, and it was only second at the box office to was it Twilight? No,
it was Twilight. Jackson Rathbone. It was smashing it. Jackson Rathbone was having a good week. He was having a good week in the box office. Not necessarily with the critics, but
no. Well, in general, he's fine. He's sorted for life. In terms of timings and what you're saying about timings, I also think it's interesting to consider that Dev was maybe shooting this at a very similar time to Slumdog.
It was just after did a little, again, doing my research this morning. And so this was just after Slumdog, and it was his next big film after that. And
I mean, that's crazy.
I think his, I think it was in a Hollywood Reporter roundtable that he basically turned around and said that he sort of regretted being a part of this film. I don't think he directly said this film, but it was sort of implied, because he said that after Slumdog, he was involved in a big sort of blockbuster, high, like big studio piece. And that he felt very unheard, that he felt very uncomfortable. It wasn't, didn't feel like it was him. He just felt like he was going through the motions. And so it sort of taught him, as well, as he put it, it taught him to the power of saying no and trusting your instincts. Because I suppose when you are a young actor in Hollywood, you just want to work. And so you'll take absolutely anything that they throw your way. And you just kind of go where the work is. But yeah, that's what I heard, was that he wasn't too happy that he'd done it.
Yeah. And I think as well, like, I mean, if you are going to go from working with Danny Boyle to working on a huge, like, I wonder what the budget was for Slumdog, actually. Yeah. So the budget for Slumdog was 15 mil. A cool 15 mil. And then the budget for Airbender was 150. So literally 10 times the budget, right? That's a different kind of working environment. Like, it's a different kind of like headspace to be in. And it's also, your value is very different in that situation, no matter whether or not you're being paid the same or not. And the one thing I would say about Dev, and I do note that he is quite picky, I would say. And I wondered if, like, this had stopped, had slowed him down. If he's been active since, you know, mid-noughties to now, you know, that's 20 years of a career, really, we're coming up to. And I don't think he's made 20 films.
As an actor, not even just films, just in general, as an actor, he's got 26 titles to his name.
And for somebody of his kind of, like, you know, standing, I would say, you know, the weight that his name carries, that, I don't think that's a lot.
Yeah, no, I agree. That's quite surprising, really, that it's, there isn't more. But I think that that pickiness is kind of, he's sort of become like the indie darling, like the yeah, independent absolutely. Film darling, like everybody, that's what he pops up in a lot, is those more independent films that have a lot of heart to the story, that have a lot to them. I mean, that's what people know him for, that's what he's brilliant at as well. I think that he's clearly very clever with what he chooses now. And probably this, I mean, you know, every job that you do, every life choice that you make is a learning curve, and maybe picking this this film reminded him that actually he didn't want to do this. But yeah, one of the other things I did want to talk about with this film is that one of the big backlashes was the fact that a lot of the characters were whitewashed.
Yeah. Like, I think that is a conversation that needs to happen. But I think what's really interesting about this film, full stop, is it feels very American in its handling of race. And when I say American in its handling, there is whitewashing of the characters, but then there's also kind of, to a certain extent, blind casting, would you say? And that is kind of where the industry was at that period of time, wasn't it? Well, I wonder if it felt progressive at the time, and it's more to do with the fact that in 2022 we have we're moving away from blind casting towards conscious casting, and we're about what we are saying in the decisions that we're making, and also right at the very beginning of those decisions, you know. And if this is kind of like a product of its time.
I do think that the landscape of casting has generally started to shift. I still don't think it's necessarily where it needs to be, but it is definitely shifting more. But there was just a lot of discussion when this film, you know, the casting of this film was released, about how, you know, you've got Nicola Peltz playing Katara and Jackson Rathbone's playing Sokka. And they're both two white actors, and the characters themselves in the actual TV show are based off, you know, Inuit tribes. So it's, it's a sort of a very clear whitewash there. And something that was pointed out when I was reading an article about it was that all of the quote unquote evil characters are non-white.
It betrays the flaw with blind casting, doesn't it? Which is, with blind casting, essentially what you're doing is you are actually relinquishing some things to bias. And there's kind of a very clear unconscious bias that is coming through there. And, you know, it's with that period of time, I did feel like that period of time was a bit of a litmus test, and people were going, you know, we're throwing caution to the wind, and we're, you know, this is progressive, this is equal, this is equality, and it's not. And this kind of idea of there not being enough roles around, etc., you know, feeding into that dialogue, is that you're not the right person for that role, so you shouldn't be seen for it. But also then with those open roles in which anybody could be going for it, to have somebody in the room who was piping up and saying, guys, have you noticed? Which, you know, that voice needs to be there.
I'd be interested to know how much say M. Night Shyamalan had on the casting. You sort of wonder how much say he had in the casting process, or whether that was just something that was completely out of his control. I don't know. As to what the decision making might have been there.
Yeah, and I mean, that's what I also kind of mean in terms of like budget for these films. Like, if you're going from a 15 mil, which is still a relatively small budget for a film, your producers aren't necessarily going to have the same kind of voice in the film that they do in a 150 mil film.
It is sort of an interesting one. A lot of people kind of viewed it as just a cash grab because of the success of the animated series. And the thing is, with animated series, it is one of those things where inevitably at some point they do end up getting made into live action because of their success, and people know that they're going to have people watching it. Something, you know, this happens with a lot of anime series, Japanese anime series. They'll eventually make their way into a live action version, and usually not always, but usually they don't really work because there's a particular style that they try and replicate in a live action that just doesn't translate as well. And I think this kind of film was definitely guilty of that. But it is being made into a live action TV series. They're in the process of that.
Really? Okay.
Which I actually think has the potential to work, because we saw in this film that the VFX works, the set design, all of that worked.
Yeah.
It's just the pacing was off. It was rushed. The casting wasn't quite right. So I feel like it seems from the casting that has been announced that they've made a bit more of a conscious effort to be faithful to the animated series. Mm. So with more time and more, you know, if the first season of the animated series is 8 hours worth of material, that's 8 hour long episodes of a live action, then I think that it has the potential to maybe work better than it does in a film. So I guess the only thing left to ask is, like, what you specifically thought about Dev Patel in this.
It's not much of him in this, is there?
We could have more Dev.
Everyone could have more Dev. So whilst we've been talking about this, I had a little look. He actually filmed this before he filmed Slumdog.
Oh, really?
Yeah, due to the scheduling, which I think is really interesting. I think, as first films go, on a huge film set, he holds his own. What would you say? Would you say the same?
Yeah. My sort of notes was that he did what he could with the stuff he was given.
Yeah, I mean, that's such a classic thing to say.
He played the character well. You know, that kind of, like, torn between what you should do and the selfishness of wanting to be back in his dad's good graces.
Classic.
So I think daddy issues. Literally, that's his character arc the whole way through this film. He's just
daddy issues.
So with that, we will move on to the next film, which is Lion.
Roar.
I'm keeping that in. Lion has 8 stars on IMDb. It was released in 2016. It was directed by Garth Davis. It is based on the book A Long Way Home by Saru Bailey, and it has a screenplay by Luke Davies. It stars Dev Patel, Nicole Kidman, Rooney Mara, and Sunny Pawar. Dev Patel and Nicole Kidman both received Oscar nominations in the supporting actor categories in 2017 for this film. Cool. Which I find very interesting that he got a supporting actor nomination and not a lead actor.
I'm not surprised.
Are you not? I was like, wait, what?
Well, I was watching this film and the main thing I feel about this film is that the trailer is dramatically different to the actual mood atmosphere of the film as a whole.
Oh, okay.
And I was expecting, like, some jump cuts, like we start off here and then we end up here and, like, we go back to that and let's explain what's going on in the present by using that. And that's what I was expecting. And then I get an hour in and I'm like, wow, I really thought this particular sort of, like, line of questioning was going to end maybe 40 minutes ago. And Dev comes in, and he comes in almost exactly halfway through the film.
Yeah, true.
And I don't think, although, and that is actually one of my main sticking points with the film, but we'll move on to that. I don't think you can give an actor a lead nomination if they've not precipitated the character. So they're not leading the character. I definitely felt like Dev was picking the character up.
Yeah, no, I see what you mean with that, actually.
And it would have been different. It would have been different if we'd picked, if we hadn't have Nicole introduce Saru into the home.
Mm.
I don't know how much spoilers are allowed on this particular podcast.
Oh, spoil away. It's fine.
Spoil away.
It's fine.
But because there was that transitional period in which the younger actor playing Saru started playing, help me out, the older Saru. There we are. That took a while. It's hot. because he did the transition, he did the legwork, I would have said that he was the lead actor. Whereas if we'd have jump cut to later on and, you know, we see, you know, Saru maybe meeting his to be adopted parents, you know, then we go to, okay, this is where we're at now. But because we see the transition, we see his brother as well, you know, we see him as a child, and that kind of like difficulty in terms of like the family dynamic is introduced whilst he's still a child.
Yeah.
So I find it really interesting.
I don't know about you, but I just really loved this film when I watched it. I was like, I really enjoyed it. I really, really enjoyed it. Did you like it?
I did. Like, I'm going to say this right now. I got turned off very, very quickly by this film. And this is maybe a judgment on my part. But firstly, it was because I think it was one of the final pictures that Harvey Weinstein made whilst he was still around.
Yeah.
So that turned me off pretty quickly. And I'm very, and I really couldn't, I really struggled to get the narrative that I have since learned, which is he wanted to churn out these Oscar winning films. Mm. That I was watching it with the tick box of the Oscar nom in my mind.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It is very Oscar bait.
Yeah, and the things that I might have enjoyed had I not sort of like had that triggered by, you know, seeing that it was produced by him.
When did you first watch this film, actually?
Oh, very recently. So
okay.
So it's not like I watched it before and sort of then sort of came to it differently.
Yeah, because I literally watched it yesterday.
yeah. I mean, that's so interesting, isn't it? I did like, one of the things that really turned me off about it was the pacing. I'm not going to lie to you.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. How did you feel about that? Like, what was it that you were like, wow, this is, I love this?
I mean, I'm a very story-driven person.
Yeah.
The pacing is usually a big part of it, but I wasn't bothered by the pacing. There were definitely moments where I thought it could have, maybe there wasn't necessarily a need for certain sections, but yeah. I thought it charted this person's life in a way that made sense from a narrative point of view. You know, you're watching this, you know, young boy get lost and eventually find his way back to where he sort of came from. It charted that in a way that made sense for me as a viewer. I felt like I was going on the journey with him rather than getting, I feel like it could definitely have done the whole flashback thing. But I felt like it did better by starting off with the young boy. And then we get to the halfway point. We've got Dev Patel playing him as an older, you know, man, and then going back to find where he's from. I think they could have done a whole thing of him being, you know, started off with the older Saru, and then we went back with flashbacks I think its pacing did its job well. For me personally, when I was watching it, I wasn't bothered by the pacing. And also with the Harvey Weinstein thing, I didn't realise, I kind of go into films as blind as possible. It feels annoying that he had his hand in it when I think that the story is so you know, it's inspiring. It's a really nice story. You know, it's based on a true story. It's something that, you know, I think was deserved to be told. And it's just annoying that it was his sort of little Oscar bait moment.
But then that as well, like, is a query for me in general, like, in terms of this Oscar baiting, I sort of was kind of like very wary whilst I was watching it. Like, this idea of, you know, rags to riches, quotation marks. I'm going to use a quotation mark there, because I don't think you can say that Saru's initial situation could be called a rags situation, you know, and I don't think you could call where he ends up as a riches situation. I found it very interesting to think about this in line with Dev's work as a whole as well, and sort of, you know, we do have power to choose our roles, but also our casting dictates that we are offered certain roles. And I kind of thought to myself, at what point, you know, how does Dev feel about this? How does Dev feel like he's associated with two of the most famous third world India portraying narratives? And I was very aware of my position of, I feel maybe like this is slightly, you know, sad story porn. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I do know what you mean. And it is certainly one of those things where I think a lot of people will watch it and be like, oh my gosh, like, this is so unbelievable. Because it is kind of mad. It's a bit of a mad story. Like, this boy gets lost in the middle of India, ends up somewhere you're completely different to where he's grown up because he got on a train, and then somehow in amongst all of those trials and tribulations ends up in Australia and being raised there, and then finds his way back. And it is kind of one of those things where I was watching, I was like, this is crazy and is very Hollywood. And I think that was what made me even more shocked, the fact that it's a true story,
because it's
almost as if it was written in a way to be that kind of like Oscar bait slash, you know, the thing that people can watch and be like, oh my gosh, how inspiring, how they, but ultimately it is inspiring and it is a nice thing to watch because it's true. I haven't read the book. I don't know how faithful an adaptation it was, but it's again, it's one of those things as well that within films, there always has to be a slightly heightened element for people to keep watching.
Well, that was what was really interesting to me. Like, I mean, this is also, watching this film has come at a really interesting time in terms of, so I've just completed the fourth module on this Cambridge course that I'm doing, which is all about nonfiction and sort of like creative nonfiction and memoir. And what has been really interesting for me is watching this film, I felt like it almost lent into hyper-realism too much. And for me, as somebody who's choosing to watch a film instead of read a memoir, when I engage with a film, I want you to lean into the metaphor of it. I want you to lean into the kind of, I want you to make those leaps for me. And I found this was most revealed to me by the fact that they don't explain why the film is called Lion until the end. And I feel like, as a metaphor, like, when we're thinking about how we're writing a film, how we're constructing a film, how we're developing character, if you give me a animal like a lion, like, let's think about that. Let's think about how that sits in what's going on. Like, what is that? Do you know what I mean? And it's not called the same thing that the memoir's called, which in itself is really interesting. Really interesting. And for me, the weighted, like, the pacing, maybe I don't mean pacing, maybe I mean waiting, because it was a 50-50 split, I found that really jarring. I would have been happier with, but maybe that's because I kind of consume three act narratives all the time, right? I'm into my three acts. Okay, lovely. Sweet, chef's kiss. Because it was 50-50 rather than third, I did find, like, I didn't know where my eye was resting. if we are to use the metaphor of photography, right? I didn't know where my eye was resting in that sort of point in time. And I felt like the acting in all regards was sensational. I thought the kids were fantastic. I thought Nicole Kidman was fantastic. I thought Dev was just so and Rooney Mara, like really, really great stuff from Rooney Mara. But I felt they were kind of like left suspended by this kind of, it might have even been the edit, you know? So I didn't feel like any of what they did led to anything or gave them a purpose or gave them like a, you know, a wider view outside of the narrative that we had. And maybe that's why for me, sometimes it did feel a little bit like sad story porn because it wasn't relating out further than just this one particular narrative.
Yeah, no, I do get what you mean with that because there are these sort of certain types of films that they do usually pop up around Oscar season that are very, as you said, sad, and they're designed in a way to, it is designed to bait the Oscars. That's the, we all know it. If a film comes out between October to January, it's Oscar bait.
It's positioned.
It always is. It's positioned to get nominated because usually that's the time when films get nominated. So I was certainly aware of that when I was watching it, but I don't know whether I just got kind of swept away with the story a little bit more.
It's
interesting you say the sort of the acts thing, but I would say that if you were going to try and find a third act within it, I would say the third act's when he goes and figures out where his original village was,
because
I feel like he'd almost given up and then he finds it randomly when he was just zooming through Google Earth.
And like I wanted them to give a little bit more weight to that, you know, like the idea that you're searching for something but then you happen upon it. But also I kind of wanted to see, I don't often say I think this film could be longer. Okay. I don't often say that. I am a 90 minute gal. I want it to be 90. I think if you can't do it in 90 minutes, you can't do it at all. But what I think, because they pushed it past the 90 minutes into this kind of, and I do find the 2 hour mark for a film is quite a weird place for a film. Okay. It feels like not quite something and not quite something else. I did feel I want to see Saru on that train processing what he's doing as he retraces his steps back. And that final scene was extremely moving. I found it insanely powerful. I don't know about you.
Yeah, oh my God. My God. And I have just never cried so much.
That was a lot, heavy. Man. Oh, Lord.
But it's right what you're saying, because it's an hour and 58 minutes, and I do think it could have been 2 hours 30, and I don't think I would have questioned it.
Yeah, and I agree with you there. I really agree with you there. And I think that's what I wanted to see.
Yeah, that ending, the ending's the most important part of this, because it's the end of his journey to finding out who he is, and I do think that it could have been less rushed. But then at the same time, as an audience member, you just want him to find his mother. And so I guess maybe from a narrative perspective, from a pacing perspective in terms of the edit and the writing, it was probably from the perspective of, okay, we need to tell this story and get him there, because people are going to be impatient at this point, because audience members can be impatient. So it maybe that's where it was coming from more than a case of, oh, we don't want to explore this. It was more of a, is an audience member, the average audience member, gonna want to sit through 30 minutes of him retracing his steps in India, or are they just gonna want us to get him to the village?
Yeah,
a bit of him retracing his steps and experiencing, you know, going through the tunnel, the archway that he went through as a kid, going through the woods that he went through as a child.
But you also know, like your identity as well, like his identity. And again, I'm not speaking from my experience, but a question that I have is like around this kind of idea of reconciliation. And when I say reconciliation, I don't mean between people, but I mean between yourself. Mm-hmm. And it feels like they tried to tease that out with the brother in terms of, you know, and the relationship with the mum. Mm-hmm. But I do wonder, and I would be really interested to read the memoir, because that for me feels like the point of this particular story in itself. How do you reconcile starting here and ending up here? And when here and there are completely polar opposites, but also growing up experiencing what he experienced, the way he was born and the first 5 years of his life, and then experiencing what basically his parents then did give to him. How do you reconcile that? How do you sit across that border? And that's what I found really interesting as well, that the train station and being able to find his hometown was just across a border. And that feels to me like this idea of border and separation, but also like duality and kind of, you know, there are big themes here that we can play with, the self before and the self now. You know, how has he changed? We did see sort of his relationship change with Rooney Mara, but I want to see that more. Like, when is he aware of his behaviour, and when is he not? When is he triggered by something, and when is he, like, do you see what I mean? These are like huge things that I think are really, really relevant, and especially in the current dialogues that we're having now with like Mo Farah's documentary and things like that. Maybe again, this is showing just how much has changed in 5 years in terms of our consciousness and in terms of how we talk about race in the current world is I'm interested in the grey areas, because I already know what happened was bloody hard. And when I say hard, I'm avoiding the word, you know, problematic, because I think it would be too black and white to call what happened wrong, you know? And there are mitigating circumstances in all levels. And I am now more interested in the mitigating circumstances than I am in the actual kind of like finding out about something. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does. I think as well, for me, when I was watching this, like I wanted a bit more, I did want a bit more of an exploration into him sort of coming to terms with his culture, because you see it very, very briefly when he goes off to university, when he meets, you know, he's at university with a couple of other you know, Indian people, and they're eating Indian food, and he's unable to she's teaching him how to eat it with the naan bread and things like that. And then he sees like this particular piece of food that sparks a memory. And then he tells them about what had happened to him. But even when they're introducing themselves in the classroom, something I found really interesting actually was when they ask, "Oh, were you born in Australia?" And he says, "Oh no, I was born in Calcutta." And then they go, "Oh, where?" And then he very quickly changes the conversation. "Oh, I was adopted. I'm not really Indian." And I wanted a bit more of an exploration into that, because ultimately it is sort of, you know, that is something that if you're adopted into a family that is of a different race to you, you're going to have to at some point come to terms with where your culture is different, or where your not necessarily your culture, but your history is different. And so I would have, that's the one thing that I would have liked to have seen a little bit more of, and perhaps a longer runtime could have allowed for this, is just a bit more of him exploring and understanding and coming to terms with the fact that he does want to know more about his culture, because there was little specks of that, like when he's a child and they're sat at the dinner table before he gets taken over to Tasmania, and the woman saying, "I'm going to teach you how to eat with cutlery," and things like that. There's these really small things that were different to how he was used to operating as a 5-year-old. It's kind of, I would have liked to have seen him coming to terms with that a little bit more, but again, I haven't read the memoir, so I don't know how that's explored within the memoir.
Yeah, and I I do wonder all of this, and I also I'm very conscious that the director writer duo didn't necessarily have the same cultural experiences, because, you know, as far as I'm aware,
they're both
think
white.
Garth and Luke are both white, right? Mm-hmm. But then also, isn't that really interesting? Because, like, I felt Nicole Kidman had a fantastic monologue, where what had happened is Saru had assumed that his mother had felt some way. And it really struck like a chord with me, as we always assume mothers feel a certain thing about a certain thing, and we never just ask them. And she has this fantastic moment of doing that. But it kind of is so, it feels so unnecessary, because we've not seen how that impacts her. You know, we haven't actually really seen the impact of her children on her life. And they're kind of like these little things that I feel were touched on because maybe the film felt they had to touch on them, and then not fully explored because they maybe felt they weren't in a position to, or like they couldn't speak about these particular things with any sort of, you know, authority. And I wonder if that's maybe why some of what we're talking about was lost in this film.
Yeah, and again, I think you are right that it, maybe it does come down to the runtime a little bit longer. You could have, you don't need to spend a lot of time on things because, you know, like I've said before in different conversations, like the audience aren't stupid. The audience can, you give them a little, they can get a lot out of it, I think, for the most part. And so you don't have to spend a whole 30, 40 minutes exploring, you know, how these children coming into the mother's life has affected her. You don't need to spend all that time. But a little bit more.
Yeah. In the edit, like the shot choices, right? Like choosing to see somebody's reaction rather than seeing what's going on. Sometimes that's more effective than following the actual action. And I felt like that is where sometimes, because the cinematography, and I think this is something I really did respect about this film, the cinematography is, it feels like it's now become cliche, but I think maybe this was the film that made those drone shots, those lingering shots, those soft shots. Like, it really has the full package, and they're used for certain reasons, but they are crystal, aren't they, really, in that cinematography. It is chosen. And I really, really loved that.
Yeah. There were just points where, that ending. I feel like we just have to talk about the ending because it just—it was so. Sorry if you haven't seen the film. pause now. come back to us when you've watched it. If you don't want to be spoiled, but the ending was just so, like, there is like a handful of things that I have like sobbed out.
Really?
This is one of them. I was literally sobbing like a fool.
I think the other thing that really got me was when she touched his hair. I don't know if you had this. There was this moment where she like brushed back his hair, and then she took one of like the other people's hands and placed it on his face, and that kind of, it wasn't quick and it wasn't like forceful, and it was just that kind of the power of that touch. And this for me was the border thing again, because it was when the moment of was completely taken, and like interesting choices from actors made all around. They didn't run towards each other, you know, they walked towards each other, and it was like watching that border and that space become smaller and smaller and smaller. And then when they touched each other, it was like, oh my god, like just so powerful, obscenely powerful. Yeah, it made me really sob. It made me really sob. Like, I know I've been quite critical about this film, but that's just me. But it really, the ending really did make me sob.
Yeah, I was just like, and I guess it's that kind of thing where you've gone through this whole journey, and like, I think that the young boy who played the young Saru, Sonny Pawar, I think was so brilliant.
Oh,
I was like, so I was just good. A little bit like, hold on a second, how old are you? Because I was just like, yeah. This little boy just absolutely dominated the screen. You were so invested in him because of the way he was playing it. And I think with a lot of children, when they act, it's very instinctual. They just kind of do, they're playing. A lot of the time they're just playing. Yeah. And I think that's what a lot of adult actors try and maintain,
replicate,
is this idea of play. And he's just going through it in a way that, and we're just so connected to it. I mean, I was just sort of so in awe. So when you get to the end point, it's like that kind of release, I guess, where you're just suddenly like, oh my God, we've gone through this entire journey with this person from the time they were a very young child to when they're now, you know, an adult.
Yeah.
And we've got the closure with them. I think that's why it was so moving for people to watch. It was like you felt that closure at the same time, because there was nothing left up in the air. They understood everything that had happened. I found it very sad that the brother, the older brother, had died on the train tracks the same day that the boy had gone.
I sort of suspected that, though. I definitely suspected that, because it made me go, why on earth would he have been left there? And it must have happened moments afterwards, right? It must have happened absolutely moments afterwards.
And so you sort of see all these things, and, you know, the fact that the mother never moved away because she hoped that he would come back. It's just really, it's sort of sad and moving.
Yeah.
And I was just, the whole thing's moving. But yeah, that ending, I was just like an absolute mess. I was like, my housemates probably think that I'm like going through a mental breakdown right now, because it was sobbing. Like, you know when you can't control it as well?
Yeah.
And you're just there like, that was me. Yeah. I was like, this is kind of a bit embarrassing.
Oh,
it's like, calm down, Jess. Calm down.
No, I'm with you there.
The footage at the end of the real Saru and his adoptive mother, and then meeting his, you know, birth mother, I was like, stop. I can't do this.
Yeah.
I was like, I can't watch this without... I just stopped crying, and then it set me off again. I was like, oh my God, stop, please. I can't keep crying. I'm getting dehydrated. I was like, it's 36 degrees and I'm dehydrated because I'm crying.
Yeah. No, it's so powerful. So powerful. But I also, like, I don't think this film would be as good as it was if there didn't feel like there was a synergy between Sonny Pawar and Dev Patel. And I definitely did feel like they have the same, they did a really good job of capturing each other's energy. And I mean, obviously, Sonny Pawar was probably just doing him, but I have questions about, like, how much time did Dev Patel spend with Sonny, and, like, how much, you know, time did Dev spend with Saru, and, like, all of these kind of things, you know. I find it very interesting, and, like, how do they feel about it now? I'd really be interested to see how they feel about it now, you know?
Yeah, that would be an interesting thing to see how they view it now. I guess also particularly in light of Harvey Weinstein and everything like that, and his involvement in the making of this. It would be interesting to know where they kind of stand with it. But I think just as a film, like, it's... it does what it's supposed to do, and I think it does it well.
Yeah.
And I just think that Dev was great.
I mean, Dev was so good. Dev was so good in it. It's interesting also that we're talking about Lion and we're not talking about Slumdog, because obviously, like, the proportion of what he did in both is very, very different, I feel.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
Maybe we need to do a bonus episode where we
talk about Slumdog
just to add a bit of extra. Because I literally was just being selfish. I wanted to watch Lion's been on my list for a really long time. I was like, oh, and now's an excuse to watch it.
Well, I wonder where Green Knight also features.
I haven't seen that one yet, but I think it's pretty. Let me have a quick look.
Just have a little look.
So the Green Knight's his ninth highest film.
Oh really?
Yeah, that's 6.6.
That's really interesting to me. Really interesting.
I haven't seen The Green Knight yet, but I did see a lot of mixed reviews for it when it came out. I think it's interesting because certain films just they kind of hit that sweet spot with as a unit, they're sort of universally accepted as being good films, and then there's others that are a bit more in the grey area. They exist with people who don't like them and people who do. Those tend to be the films that I enjoy watching because I want to be able to figure it out on my own. I don't want to know what everyone thinks about it. I want to go and watch a film and be like, okay, so you didn't like that, but I did. And that's kind of why I really enjoy, even just this podcast when I've had guests on, the difference in opinions.
Yeah.
I think it's always really interesting to hear. Yeah, I just was very moved by the film. And just impressed with the performances. I thought the film looked beautiful as well.
Yeah, it really did look beautiful. Really beautiful.
Yeah. I just wanted to briefly discuss what you think of Dev Patel's career as a whole. Is there any other films of his that you've really enjoyed, or other performances of his that you've really enjoyed that you'd like to mention?
Performance wise, I mean, I really enjoyed his performance in The Green Knight. I did think The Green Knight had some, issues that he needed to work out, maybe in the edit suite. But yes, I thought that was really interesting as for him and his sincerity. And I don't think that film would have been greenlit by A24 or even given that spin if he hadn't have been a part of it. Mm-hmm. I really am a big fan of his work in the Exotic Marigold Hotels, in both of them. Mm-hmm. I think he does a very good job with a very difficult part. Actually, something I would say, have you seen his Modern Love episode?
I haven't. No, I haven't watched any of Modern Love.
Get on that, because actually it's a really good little episode. And I think it displays his strengths really, really well. Really well.
Is there any other actors that you think I should discuss on this podcast? Is there anyone that you're like, you need to talk about that? You need to talk about their highest and lowest.
Well, somebody that I have been thinking about recently, mainly because I finished watching it, and this is moving into TV rather than film, but I think Jemima Kirk is a very interesting actor to discuss, her background of work, who she's worked with, and what she's doing as an actor. I think she is one to watch because she's not what I call an actor's actor. She's ended up being an actor, and she takes her role as an actor very, very seriously, but she doesn't engage with the business side of it at all.
Okay. Do you want to tell the people what you're up to, where they can find you if they wanted to follow you?
Oh my gosh. I mean, I think if you wanted to follow me, all you'd get is sort of sad retweets of the Poetry Foundation on Twitter. You can find me, I'm just Zoe Wells. I've got a website. I've got a short film in the pipeline. And that's been in pre-production for far too long. And we're now getting moving, which is great. Pandemic, what you gonna do? What you gonna do?
As always, you can follow me on, I'm Jess_Roland on Twitter. And Jess Roland on Instagram. You can follow the podcast. We're Better Bad Pod on both Instagram and Twitter. But before we go, Zoe, you get a nice little sneak preview. I'm going to announce who we're going to be discussing next. So the Tom Cruise episode is still in the pipeline. I'm going to contact my guest for that and see when they're next available to record. But I got a little message off of someone saying that they would love to come on and discuss this actor. And that is Dwayne Johnson.
Interesting. Very interesting.
That's what I thought. I was like, this is going to be interesting. So I went onto IMDb and I found out what their highest and lowest rated films were. So obviously Dwayne Johnson has been in a variety of different things, including like ones where he plays himself because he's just kind of like a celebrity.
Oh my gosh, of course.
But his highest rated is actually Moana, where he voices one of the characters, and which is then followed by Fast and Furious 5. So I'm going to speak to my... So Moana has 7.6 stars, Fast and Furious 5 has 7.3. I'm going to speak to my guest and we're going to decide whether we want to do Moana or Fast and Furious, because obviously a lot of this is about discussion of their acting, but voice acting is still very much acting, and we haven't had an animated... relevant. Film on the podcast yet, so it could be really interesting to discuss. His lowest rated was actually a film that has 2.6 stars, Lord help us, which was called Long Shot, which I've never heard of. I've never heard of this film called Long Shot, but I did have a quick search and I cannot find it anywhere to watch.
Really?
So if anyone knows, then let me know. But the next above that where he's actually acting and isn't just playing himself is the film called Tooth Fairy.
Oh my gosh, I remember Tooth Fairy. Oh my gosh.
That has 5 stars. So if we fail to find Long Shot, if we fail to find it, we will just watch Tooth Fairy. I will do my best to see if I can find Long Shot somewhere. But yeah, I'm just going to... You might get a little surprise as to what we're actually going to be watching and discussing on the next episode. Zoe, thank you so much for joining me.
No,
this has been
really
interesting discussion. Thank you.
This has been so interesting.
I hope you've enjoyed yourself.
Thank you, Jess. I have really enjoyed myself. And thank you so much for having me on. Honestly, there is nobody else I'd rather talk about.
I will see the rest of you next time on Better Than Bad. Thank you so much. Wait. It's not the end yet. Because I realised when I was editing this that I had forgotten to ask the most important question. The whole point of this podcast is to ask the question, which film did we prefer? So I'm back, editing Jess is back in the room to tell you that I preferred Lion. I think that was pretty obvious. And then I sent a little text to Zoe and was like, I was dumb. I forgot to ask you the most important question. And then she let me know that we are indeed on the same page. And her preferred one of the two films was also Lion. So now it is actually the end of the podcast. And I will see you again next time on Better Than Bad. Thank you so much, guys.